and Dalton never blasted them. See, I do think that the Russian Revolution was one of the greatest things that ever happened. I do. But that doesn't mean that you support everything that the leaders of that movement did. You know, there are things that they made mistakes. Even Lenin, who I think is one of the great men, made some mistakes. How can you breaking through to a thing, you know, like the guy who wrote those books, Broken Earth and everything, I forget his name, but I read every one of them. I influenced the judge once to read these books, and he changed his mind about the Soviet Union by reading these books. This guy came here from Russia when he was 11 years old and became quite a renowned writer. And he wrote for Broken Earth. But literally that's what happened in Russia. They broke the earth and everything. And then the things they went out, then red bread, then the red cloud lifts, you know. Things got better and everything. And more people began to support it. Raymond, Colonel Raymond Robbins, who was not a Bolshevik, but he was an honest guy, and he supported Lenin, he supported the Russian Revolution. He came around saying that this is a lie about the, because they had said that that as soon as the communists came in, they had the community of women, you know, and all that nonsense, all of which was a lie, you know. And,
well, Barbara, over, well, Czechoslovakia was in 68. What about in 67 with the Arab-Israeli War? What happened? Now, here was another big
split. You see, the party supports the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union supports the Arabs. Now, it's true the Soviet Union did make the statement that Israel has a right to live, has a right to have, and everything. But they've been on the Arab side. They've given the arms to the Arabs, far superior to anything that the Israeli could have.
Well, what effect did this have in your...
I support, Dorothy and I don't agree. I support the Israeli, even though I know there's some Semitic amongst them too. Of course there's some. The Irgun, I think, were a fascist element, you know. They're not all. But by and large, the Arabs have such a vast territory. It's been over 27 years now. They could have put all of those displaced Arabs. One thing to say, the Israeli never threw the Arabs out. She begged them to stay. There were almost a million Arabs who did stay, who have the best jobs they ever had in their lives, and who never turned against the Israelis when they had the war. They didn't go ahead and support the Arabs. They didn't fight.
Your position on Israel is not the party position. What effect does this have on your standing in your club and in the party?
Well, they would never throw me out of the party, but they just don't agree with me.
Do you openly discuss?
Oh yes.
Well, is there? Because I know in some groups there's a split, and many people left the party because of this. Did this happen over the Arab-Israeli thing?
See, I haven't been able to attend meetings because, see, over a year ago when I was so very, very sick, you know, that I didn't think I'd live at all. So I don't know what happened in my club, but I know in my club, Bill Taylor became chairman in place of Dorothy Rose. Bill Taylor, he doesn't know very much. He's a nice guy because Henry Winston stayed at Bill Taylor's house, and Henry Winston is the one who wanted Bill Taylor to be chairman. So Bill Taylor is chairman. It wasn't because he was voted in. He's chairman because he was appointed, just like Ford was appointed by Nixon. So he's in. But Bill Taylor would come to Dorothy to ask her, how do I settle this? You know, you know that Dorothy knows more than any one of them. None of them really know more than Dorothy. Because Dorothy reads the publications from all over the world. I have really never known anyone personally who read everything like Dorothy does. And her son does the same thing. Now, Dorothy's in correspondence with the Australian Party.
Mm-hmm.
She's in correspondence now, even with the... she gave a talk on Portugal just at Irvine just last week.
But before you got sick, earlier in the 60s still, what happened within the party over the Arab Israeli Communion section?
The Jews supported the Arabs. The Jews were afraid to, Gene Sereno, who is of Italian origin, he was born in New York and everything. See, he would always agree with me, but not at a club, not openly at a club. He is one of those that, he knows who speaks to kids. He also gets, not very many, but he gets a few fringe benefits. Mm-hmm. And you know what Mark said about when they asked him, how are you going to contend with the walls of China? No one at one time could breach them. He said, naked self-interest is the battering ram that breaks down not only the walls of China, but every impediment. Naked self-interest is the battering ram. Never forgot those words.
Well, Barbara, around the issue of Israel, I know that many, for instance, Yevaland, stopped her association with the party totally over the position on Israel, but also because of the anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. Now, what kinds of feelings did you have and discussions did you have around that?
Well, of course, personally, I think the over-Semitism, the anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, I think is overplayed. I don't think there's much of it. But, certainly, if there's only one case of it, it's bad. And the fact that there isn't as much of it is no excuse for any of it. That any of it could still be there is a sad and tragic thing. A very tragic thing. When I read in the socialist magazine, not Jewish Currents, I gave you some of that, didn't I, Jewish Currents?
Did you see it?
Well, I think it's one of the very best. The most objective, the most honest, the most... Mm-hmm. And there's the act of communism, there's no question of it. And they say, too, they can't tell you some of them in the Israel itself is split on those things, you know. They don't all go along in Israel either on it. But one thing, in Israel, there are two communist parties. But they're not in jail. In the Arab countries, the communist party is in jail. And I know that they want to keep this going, like Arafat. And to me, if I heard that he was assassinated today, I'd be glad. And I don't believe in assassinations. I don't think it ever solves anything. But I think he's just he's a very dishonest person and everything. Because he did say, when they accepted him, he said, we wouldn't guarantee anything. They have no right to be there.
Well, Barbara, would you consider yourself a Zionist, though?
No. No.
What do you see as the distinction between your position and the Zionist position?
The Zionist position is a very sectarian one that. And I tell you the truth, I accept that Herzl was supposed to have founded it when he first found out. He didn't even know what about a Jew or anything, you know. He was a scholar. And accepted the traditions and the scholarship of Greek history and everything. But when he found out, without knowing anything at all about it, he was subject to anti-Semitism. Then he found out, just like Einstein. Einstein said, too, I didn't know what it meant about being a Jew. I was a scientist. I was a human being. But Hitler made me aware that I was a Jew. And I dare not forget it.
Because is that how you feel, that despite your lack of identification as being a Jew, that you see the attack on Israel as a basic anti-Semitic attack and an attack
on I do. I say part of it is that. But I don't hold with all the things that are going on. I don't like their Minister of Defense. I don't like the guy with the one eye. I don't think he's a nice person. He went to Vietnam and justified Vietnam. So he's not a nice person. He's a fascist and everything. So, but Israel must survive. They have no place to go. They have no other place to go. See, Carol Jane was very troubled about, she sent us, I have the Eye of Stone. Did you read it? I have it, by the way.
I don't know which one you're talking about.
He said the Palestinians also have something, you know, you have to protect their lives, too. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that I have to protect the Palestinian rights at all. They've been out of that country for 25 years. No chased them out. They ran away. The urge to stay. Nobody. But he said, sneered at that and said, well, but it made it almost possible for them. I thought they made it impossible for them. They asked them to stay and everything. So the rich pashas who didn't want any, you know, Israel was a desert. It was just absolutely nothing but a rocky desert. But they've made that desert bloom like a rose. They have developed things in it. They have changed the whole thing of it. Oranges, all kinds of vegetables and fruits grow there now, but never before.
Well, Barbara, but don't you think that is it difficult for you to support what's basically a theocratic state, though, which is...
It's difficult for me to support the Arabs in this position. I'm not a Vietnamese, but I support the Vietnamese with all my heart and soul.
Do you see Israel as being a theocracy, though?
A democracy?
A theocracy.
Well, no, I don't think it is, because although there is the religious sect there, they don't have that much power. But they have more than they should have. And, of course, Orthodox religion to me is fascism, always. And the Jewish is no different than any other.
Well, what about the idea of a binational state?
You see, in a binational state, what part of it are you going to have and what part are? And the Arabs have said all along that there's no such thing as telling them that they have a right. They have no right to be there.
They've
never granted the right to Israel.
But do you see that as a feasible solution? Is that something you would support?
I would support it if it were feasible, but I don't think it would, because I think there would be a constant war between them.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, despite your very strong feelings over this, you wouldn't publicly leave the party as a, particularly the charter member, as a show of your...
No, mm-hmm. No. Now, at 90, wouldn't it be a little bit silly? And believe me, I wield no power, no influence of any kind. So some people sometimes come over, they think because I've been in so long and I've lived so long, perhaps I know more than they think that I do. Because, you know, age doesn't, it's a foolish thing to think age gives you any wisdom or any more understanding than anything you ever had and had it when you were younger. I doubt very much the fact that you get older that you would have it. But you have strong feelings. But I say it has to be based on facts.
Mm-hmm.
What are the facts in the matter? That's why Jewish currents, I think, is valuable, because they do quote for the facts.
Well, Barbara, now since you brought up the issue of age, I was going to wait and do this as the last thing, but what, looking back now, sort of a long view back over 50, 60 years in the Communist Party, how do you feel about the party? How do you feel, what do you feel it has accomplished or your membership in it has meant? Or also the party as a mass organization. Looking back over this whole 56 years now, what kind of thing would you reflect on?
I think looking back over it, in the beginning especially, where it opened a new field to people, where it opened a new, where the Soviet Union, for once, capitalism was not supreme. It had an opposing force. And to think that with all the things against it, with the most powerful forces in the world against it, ready to destroy it, Churchill had called for an invasion of it. We, you know, there is a book by a general that when we invaded Archangel there, we were ready to destroy it under Wilson and everything. And yet, in spite of all that, the Soviet Union survived famine, starvation, arms on every side that they were willing to give them. They survived, and now is as great a nation as the United States. The United States has to take the Soviet Union into account. She cannot discard them. She can't ignore them. She can't ignore the force they are.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, looking back over the long view in terms of the American Communist Party?
Well, the American Communist Party, I think that they made some very sad mistakes. I still think it was a tremendous thing that it gave people a medium through which they could understand and meet and organize and voice and have a voice in things and have an understanding of what was going on. Because through that party, they also were in touch with other parties that were coming on. But the mistake I think they made was, like when the thing, a strife between Lovestone and Foster came up, that they went to the Soviet Union to ask Stalin to decide, which was a stupid thing. Why should Stalin know Russia? What does he know about America? The Americans should have decided here, not left it to Stalin to decide. And it made an enemy of Lovestone, where he became really a fascist. Well, the very fact that he could become a fascist shows he's a rotten guy, because the fact that he was disappointed and thwarted, and perhaps unjustly, should never have made him do that. They have the rules for him treated. The oppressor, you know, the thing I find now is that they mistook me, and I know him, and I'm very fond of this. He writes in socialist papers, and he comes and talks at the Unitarian Church, and he stays at Pauline's house, and he and his wife Helen have built a kind of a farm in, I think it's in New Hampshire.
Mm.
You know who I mean?
Oh, Scott Meering?
Yes, Scott Meering. Scott Meering also was thrown out of the party. But did that make Scott Meering a loves tonight or a fascist? And I love Scott Meering. And I know Scott Meering and everything. But Scott Meering is still a decent, fine person who writes objectively.
Well, do you think that that position in the 20s, are you saying that it was just that incident, or it was the way in which the Communist Party generally was tied to the Soviet Union throughout its years that was bad?
Well, I think a whole lot of it did happen in the 20s that way. That, you know, you never know which has the most influence, but it was bad that that everything had except, like Ella Wiesbauer said, that we will tolerate no criticism in the Soviet Union. You love your children, but you never think of them. I think, after all, criticism is a very important instrument, a very important method. It has to be constructive criticism. It has to be based on facts. It must be objective. That, I think, is very necessary to anything. And any time you say you dare not criticize, that's the Pope stepping in, the admissions of the Pope, and that I don't agree with.
Well, Barbara, how do you think that the party could have been more effective over the past 56 years?
If they had allowed more discussion.
And what do you think that would have done?
One of the things I remember the party did that I don't think, you see, just a few weeks ago, two Italian comrades were here. One, the daughter of a former leader in the Communist Party. And I got to know them pretty well. And they're very, very nice people. And I remember several years ago asking an Italian comrade who stayed here for a few days, I said, tell me how the Italian Communist Party grew to be the biggest party outside of the Soviet Union. What did you do? He said, you see, we never forgot our humanity. And we found someone who was interested who came to us. If he had no job, You didn't tell him that we have no influence now. When socialism comes, you'll have a job. We went and got him a job right then and there. We found a place for him to live in so that he could eat and everything. But why would he leave us then? Then he not only stayed, but brought others too. And then they learned about socialism, and they learned that through union there is strength. Nothing was ever said truer than that. And that if you don't, and that you speak up, that you find anything that's wrong, you speak up. For who speak you if you not speak up? So never take anything, never let anybody say you dare not ask questions. Tagliani, of the Italian party was different than mostly. He was against the Soviet Union going into Czechoslovakia. See, he was one of the... So was the English party, as far as that's concerned. So was the French party, you know. But this Italian comrade, I never forgot him. I only saw him for a few times. He stayed here for about a night or two, you know, but he said, you don't forget the humanities. You don't forget that as a human being, they have needs. And if you don't satisfy those needs, they're going to try to go where they will be satisfied, where they can't wait for pie in the sky anymore, for a communist pie in the sky, or the capitalist pie in the sky. You have to. So that, and
you,
I think...
And you think the American Party never
they didn't. Oh, no, they didn't do it. They didn't. I remember how many times coming home from a meeting in Berkeley and finding a half a dozen people sleeping on my living room floor, but finding blankets and everything all the time, you know, and sleeping there. And I remember when it was so hard in the 30s to get a job, and someone finally got a job, finally, and the party, without any concern at all, sent him to some other place where he would again not have anything at all. I said, how can they dare to do that? Why don't they send one who's already unemployed? But to send one who just got a job after all these years? I said, that isn't human. That is just, I don't think socialism is benefited by a thing like that.
Why do you think that was true, Barbara, that the party did?
Because I think those people, most of them who were to be ahead of it, thought only in terms of the... Of that and never of the greater good for the greater many, you know, or helping right away. And they would say, look, I remember here one case too, that a woman who came to us and everything said she had been a nurse and everything, but in the 30s, and when she joined the Communist Party, and when she asked them to help her, and she said, look, we're not an agency, we're not a benevolent society. And she said, look, do you agree with that? I said, no, I do not agree with that point of view. I said, I think we should have, if it was necessary to sign for you or to help in any way, we should have done it.
Well, do you think that it was just a matter of different temperaments, if, say, those who came to power in the Communist Party in Italy compared to the Americans? Why do you think that there was this difference between them?
I think some of them... Many, many of those who came to power were opportunists, you know. I didn't know the guys on top like Dorothy did. Dorothy met with them, and I didn't know them. Now, Elizabeth Gurley King, I knew. I knew Elizabeth Gurley King. And I knew more about her, and I knew her personally. I don't think she had a lot of tragedies in her life and everything. She was really a daughter of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
But a few of them that I met afterwards, you know, it seemed to me that they began to have an arrogance, you know, a kind of a feeling of being in some way over and above. And I think that they had that because they didn't know as much as they pretended to know. And they protected their ignorance by having an attitude of being beyond any criticism of anything. Don't you think so?
I don't know. Because it is peculiar that the American Communist Party seems to have been the one that was the most, or the least independent.
Well, that's true. You see, I often thought that when I was in the Socialist Party, that we really had more feeling for one another than in the Communist Party. And in the IWW, I had quite a few friends in the IWW. You know, I liked them a whole lot better than the Communist Party. Because they would go out for one another and help one another. And I really liked the IWW.
And you found that missing in the Communist Party?
I thought, except in a few cases where you became very good friends with someone like the Dietrichs. The Dietrichs had it, but I knew some of those, and I only knew them slightly, never well, and knew them more by what they did than really. I thought they were arrogant, and I didn't think that they were really very concerned too much, but they really cared more about their influence and everything. Now, I didn't know Dennis personally. I know Peggy really well, but I didn't know Dennis, you know. And I knew Foster very slightly. Dorothy knew him, but I thought, as a speaker, Foster was a fizzle.
Well, Barbara, it seems that your life for the past 50-some years, with both your personal life, your political life, your social life, were all totally tied to the party. Do you have, looking back, do you have any feelings about how
I've learned to be humanist also. And I was at the Unitarian Church. I told Richmond once, you know, if we live closer to you, my grandson would come to your church, because there's no Father, Son, and Holy Ghost there, you know. And then I was very active in the IELD, you know, because these are definite things that you were doing for someone. Those were the things that were really definite, what they were doing for the prisoners. There's no question of that.
You saw that as being more concrete than many of the party activities?
That's right. And I remember when a guy by the name of, I think his name was Howard Moore, he was the Negro. He was a powerful speaker. And he was working for the ILD and trying to organize them down south. And you know what was happening in the 30s down south. So he said that when he spoke, an old black man came up to him and looked at him. He said, you know, Mr. Moore, what you say is, but tell me, isn't it dangerous to belong to your party? And this man said, long and earnestly, I looked into the black face of my brother for how well I knew his terror, the things that he had been with and everything, and I would not speak lightly to him. And I said, yes, brother dear, it is dangerous to belong, but not half as dangerous as not to belong. And I said, and what did you mean by that? The saying that at least you had a voice, you had someone to speak up for you. But if you were alone there, who's going to speak for you? So sure, it's dangerous if they find out and everything. So you take every precaution you can for them not to find out. But you know that there's someone behind you there, someone's naked woman. Otherwise, you know what's happening.
But it seems that from other things we've talked about, that you very often felt that it was a mistake to join the party, that very often people were in a much better position to do things by not
joining. Well, the ones I thought that of were mostly the clergy. Mm-hmm. These were teachers whose sympathies and ideals were with us, but who would lose the other influence if they came into the party. So they were doing anything that they were doing would have been done in the party too. But if they were members of the party, they would lose the influence of those other people. Like the Shelley group, you know, with, kind of the cultural and...
So you, as a general position then, that wasn't your position. It was just in certain cases you thought that people would lose the influence they had by joining the party.
That's right. They would only have the influence they already possessed. They weren't adding anything to it. But this way they were adding to it because they could go and tell these other people, and because they were respected members of it, both by education and profession and everything else, and speak and make it known and bring in support. So you see yourself that it was a positive thing that they would lose that.
Barbara, there's a couple of things that I'd still like to cover. Maybe we can finish up with those. First of all, if you can describe for me the case against Dan and how that all began and why.
Well, you know, so important is that case of Dan that now everyone who goes to take a law course, they have to learn about Dan's case. Because this is the first case in the history of the United States where a man has been deprived of his Social Security and deported on such flimsy evidence.
Now, why did they go after him? Because he was Dorsey's stepfather, what do you think started it all? And do you recall the sequence of events?
Well, he never made speeches. He wasn't an important person anyway. And he was a kind of an interesting person. He was a very good looking man. And he felt these things very deeply, but he didn't know too much. I told you what he said about, he said, who was Marx to tell him that he could not expect to have this, that, until we had a developed economy? I said, well, go and give up your job. He said, well, how would I eat? I said, well, just say it's not Marx, but your need that's telling you that you need a job. So I said, it isn't Marx. Marx is only explaining why and everything. And Lenin said that he learned more from the mistakes of the communards in the early communist thing in France than through anything else. Because the mistakes they made, they were idealists. And they were protecting the bourgeois banks for the bourgeoisie and everything. And Lenin said that's the first thing he learned, that he took over. They didn't belong. Those things didn't belong to those people. They belonged to the people, and he took it over for the people. Very smart man.
Well, what started the case against Dan?
Well, they were saying, you know, they were really taking an awful lot of people in all the time. There was a kind of a terror, you know, and everything.
It began when, what year did it actually begin?
Well, he didn't join the party until 1936 or 7. Mm-hmm. And he was a Tolstoyan. When he came over here from Bulgaria, he was a Tolstoyan. He wasn't a socialist even. And there was no Communist Party in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a Communist Party until 1919.
Mm-hmm.
They accused him that he came in as communist. But there was no Communist Party.
Well, when did the case against him begin? In the 50s then?
In the, in 56 he was deported. It began in 53, I think. And it was just one of those things, he would talk a lot. I'll tell you one thing, he had a lot of grit and courage because he never refused to go anywhere they would send him. He didn't know enough to do anything, you know. I told you what he did. He went to a home and he found a young Negro woman that he had known in San Diego, both were studying electricity. And he said to her, do you have a job? And she said, no. He said, well, give me your address. And he says, I know a lot of people that need a maid. Well, that was anathema, you know, to think that all you can look for if you're black would be the bucket, as they called it, the mopping bucket. You know, she brought him up on charges. But he was a chauvinist and everything. So Dorothy said, look, this man doesn't know enough. You know he's well-meaning. Are you going to go ahead and bring charges up on him and castigate him for something he doesn't even understand?
Well, he joined the party when you rejoined, is that it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But, so you see, he was a guy hard to understand. He was so cocky, he was so sure he could come back whenever he wanted to. Because everyone told him, look, it's Romo.
Mm-hmm.
The left will never get back. He didn't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
He thought, he knew that hadn't been a communist when he came in here. So then he wrote to me, why don't I do things and everything more for him? I wrote to the Social Security people in Washington, I think I told you this, and the head of it from San Francisco wrote to me, I am coming down, not because of you, because I'm going to be at the state building anyway, And as long as I am, Bill, you can come and see me and I'll listen to whatever you have to say. You can bring your lawyer if you want to. So when I went down to see him, he's a very pleasant man. Big, handsome guy. And he said, one thing I want you to understand, Mrs. Nestor, that I merely carry out the laws that are made. I don't make those laws. I don't like any of them any more than you do. So if you and your friends can do anything to take those laws off the statute book, I'd be very glad.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, this is my job to enforce them, to carry them out.
Now, this is after he was already deported.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. So he says, tell me why he didn't fight it some more. I said, you see, it's very hard to understand a person like him. He was really very anxious to see what was going on in Bulgaria now under socialist rule. And if the government was paying for his transportation, well, that was a feather in his cap. He was gaining something by it. Because he told those who, when the time came, if he wanted to come back, he could come back. But he's finding out it's very difficult. I said, but really, you had no business to deport him. Because there was no socialist, there was no communist party at that time. So he wasn't a communist.
So the charge was that he had come in, that when he came into the United States, he came in as the birth of another.
Yes. Yes. Well, then, and he's the first one in all the history of the United States that had been away from him, you know. Just because of the charges brought against him. And those charges had never been substantiated anyway.
Now, this was, at that time, there were not that many deportations, were there?
No.
I mean,
no, there were some. There was a Greek guy, I forgot now what, the one they deported. Really, he was a damn nuisance, and I was definitely different. He came over all the time and didn't know, but he was more of a schnorrer than anything else.
Oh, so there were several party members who were aliens who were deported then?
There were some, but not very many.
Well, why do you think they
Because they couldn't have touched him except for himself. You know what he did? He wrote in Bulgarian to a former school teacher that he'd known when he was in Bulgaria. She was about 3 years younger than he. And he wrote to her and he said, you know, I have to say, when I write to Bulgaria, I have to say that I don't want to be deported. Then they can deport me because no socialist country will accept anyone who doesn't want. But I really want to go there and everything. And now that Andrechen is no longer visible, and I think they killed him. So he said, so she wrote back, she says, but you didn't know that my brother, who was a little boy when you were here, is now the Minister of Finance, or Foreign Minister or something. And if you mean it, if you really want to come here, he will send you a visa. So he sent him a visa. Now, none of us knew anything about this. I didn't get him from the letter, I didn't know. But after he did it, the friend of the Bulgarian who was my friend, and he had gone to school with him, you know, gone to Bulgarian schools and knew him from the time he was a little boy. Fred Pitts, who lives in Hitler, came to see me and said, you know, Fred, said you want me to send all these letters, but I'm not going to send him anything because I don't know what I may be implicating or somebody may be, you know, I know they read it all. So I want you to read all of these letters yourself before I send them. Then we found a letter that he'd gotten from the teacher who had said, so then Fred read the letter. She said, do you see why Dan was taken up? This is the letter. He said, of course, in Washington, they have people who